Hey everybody, welcome back to the Beyond the Peloton podcast. I'm your host, Spencer Martin from the Beyond the Peloton newsletter. Andrew Vaunce, my co-host from the Choose the Hard Way podcast, thebetterlab.io, is back from his immersive Bentonville experience. I cannot wait to hear more about that. Andrew, do you want to say anything about your podcast, your company, before we get going?
Yeah, the Better Lab. Hey, your relationship with sleep, Spencer, and everyone listening, is one you're going to have your entire life. So you might as well make it a great one. The Better Lab helps you build mindful, science-backed practices to sleep better in the time you have. Check us out at thebetterlab.io. Get the app and get moving today. And come check out Choose the Hard Way, the podcast about how hard things build stronger humans who have more fun everywhere you listen. I've got a great guest coming up this week, Spencer. He was on a mid-tier French continental pro team and has quite an interesting experience. Wow. He was a rocket scientist before that. He left being an aerospace engineer.
Chris Huberti?
Different one. Whoa. Yeah, there are a couple of them floating around, but it's, if you want to know what it's like to be on one of those mid-tier French teams having your pasta weighed and taken away from you, you got to come check this episode out. It's dropping on Wednesday with Joe Petrowski.
I can't wait. I'd say that's the peak interest of my cycling. What I want to know most about in cycling is that mid-tier French teams. I can't get enough of it. I'm actually getting on a transatlantic overnight flight to France right after this podcast, so I might need the Better Lab to keep me going this week. But Andrew, I've got a question for you. Liège-Bastogne-Liège was yesterday. Tadej Pogačar won 6th monument of his career, so he's tied with, not with Eddie Merckx, he's tied with Matthew Vanderpoel. But what's interesting, through his first 13 monument starts, he has 6 wins. Eddie Merckx, through his first 13 monument starts, 3 wins. So he needs to do this for 10 more years, but we're on pace where he could be as good as Eddie Merckx if he keeps winning like this. I have a question though. Is pro cycling just boring now? Is this how it is? The 7 out of the last 8 monuments have been solo victories. They're pretty decisive. There's not a lot of intrigue. If you think about Jasper Philipsen at Milan-San Remo, we didn't know how lucky we were last month. We thought, wow, this is going to be a great cycling season. Oh no. Now it's just long-range solo attacks and the strongest guy wins. Is this how it is these days?
Jasper Dabadou. I mean, if you have to ask, I think you know that the answer might actually be to go watch World Cup mountain bike racing.
Yeah, well, this is my next.
Never a dull moment over there, whether it's short track, XCO. I really wish that they broadcast cross country marathon. I don't think it happens at the same venues or if it's a different series or what, but they do have a cross country marathon world championship, which is somewhat like gravel actually, but they're on those flat bar bikes. But I mean, if you want drama, if you've never tried this, get out there on your mountain bike with those 4-foot wide handlebars and a pack of 100 people and tell me how you like it and what happens.
Yeah, I guess it was always on GCN, but something about mountain biking being on Max, I'm just throwing it on and I need it because these races finish. I do the newsletter. Please read the newsletter. I'm having fun breaking down these races, but at a certain point, just putting historical performances into context and being like, no, I promise you, they're not boring. This is unbelievable what we're seeing, can get a little tiresome. And I'm like a junkie for these cross-country mountain bike races now. I'm a fan. This might just be a mountain bike podcast now. The U.S. is dominating. I don't know what happened. Maybe it's just because it's in the Americas. It's in South America, but maybe that's putting the Americans at an advantage. But I'm very excited to see how really the race for the women's 2 spots shape up as we get closer to the Olympics. I think that's going to be pretty spicy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's 4 chilies for sure. And it races like LBL, while Pog is time trialing away, what did he do? He put in like 15 seconds per kilometer and 4 kilometers or something like that.
Yeah, it might actually be a little bit more than that. It was really impressive.
Yeah, it was absurd. Then you start to think things like, wow, Romain Bardet, what are you doing up here, man? Good to see you.
Hey. Where did he come from? Yeah. Only 2nd career monument podium. I might be in his last year as a pro. I think he might be retiring.
Yeah, not bad. Or, you know, there are a lot of details to pick apart in these races, which is, of course, part of what we're going to do today. But I mean, like when Pog went Karapaz goes with them. We know how much teams are putting into marginal gains. We know that EF in particular has the ear flap helmet. I don't know what you want to call it. And there's Karapaz trying to keep up with Pog, and he's got his glasses stuck in the vents of his non-aero helmet. And I was just wondering, what's going on here?
Well, I'm glad Karapaz did that, because
I was as well.
I don't think it was a boring race. I mean, we can talk in a larger sense about the Ardennes. I think they probably should be moved on the calendar. I just think they don't quite fit there. But setting that aside, Pogacar goes, he's seated. As Lance would say, he's finger in the nose. Like, he's not even really breathing that hard. And Carapaz looks like he is riding to survive. Like, if he doesn't get up this climb in a certain time, they will execute him on the top of the climb. That's how hard he looked like he was riding. And he was just losing ground every second to Pogacar. So it gave us a nice little visual cue of like, oh, wow, we're seeing the fastest time up Labrador. I believe he broke the record by 8 seconds, which was Remco Evenepoel's time of last year. If anyone thinks, oh, if Remco was here, this would have been a race. No, this wouldn't have been a race. I went back and watched Remco's attack. He couldn't even drop Tom Pidcock. So yeah, if you're not dropping Pidcock on Labrador, you're not beating Pogacar. But yeah, that was completely the wrong move by Carapaz. The thing about Bardet was not responding on Labrador. He was just racing for second place. Like, the smart riders knew the moment Pogacar attacked right there, it was game over and they should race for second.
Yeah. I mean, another detail I saw, I can't remember which rider it was. Someone in a 4 or 5 person break had a cycling cap on under their aero helmet. And I know we see a lot of this, particularly in races when it gets wet. I haven't seen, you know, Specialized has put almost everything in the wind tunnel. I have not seen any data around what happens when you put a cycling cap with a protruding bill on underneath your aero helmet. I suspect the results might not be great. But I mean, with that Carapaz attack as well, I mean, as you noted, everyone probably knew, like, we're racing for second, might as well save the bullets for later in the race when they're going to count. But do you think Carapaz was there because Ben Healy, who I would think would be the rider that EF was trying to position for the win, just couldn't go with that attack? Or did he read the race better? Or what do you think was going on?
I kind of think Ben Healy, I mean, same thing, you could see like Schelmoza, the other guys back there. I think he just thought, we're already going so fast because, yeah, like UAE had an odd race. They had a lot of riders up there, but it seemed like Domi right. Novak just did all the work. And as soon as Novak pulled off, he was going pretty hard in the lower slopes of Labrador. Pogacar just went. I kind of think Healy just thought, I can't go that fast. Let's just stay with the rest of the people. Healy, kind of a weird race. He's the one who pulled Bardet off the front for that breakaway that got him second. But then Healy got dropped in the last climb. So I think Healy kind of played it perfectly to ride for the podium. He just needed to be able to stay with Roman Bardet. I can't imagine, you hate to even say this, but at this point, people shouldn't even respond to Pogacar attacks. It's just a fool's errand.
Why do you think Israel Premier Tech was on the front pulling UAE for what seemed like more than an hour?
Yeah, that was a little weird, wasn't it?
Do you think there was a deal inside the Peloton on that one? I don't know if that kind of stuff goes on anymore, but back in the day, you know, it'd be like, hey, you know, you do this here, we'll do that there. Maybe we give you 10 grand. Like, what do you think was shaking there?
That's kind of what it looked like.
It's like very UAE, weird.
Because UAE was going hard on the climbs and then not that hard on the flats.
Right.
But it was like, oh, we have a second team here that's going hard on the flats. I kind of think, I was thinking a lot about this. It might have just been because there was, who knows why this was happening. You know, the contenders with 100K to go are like, wow, we're getting to the hard part of the race. We should stay at the front. This is really important. Matthew Vanderpoel goes to the back to go to the team car to take leg warmers off. He's chilling back there, taking his jacket off. Why he's not just doing that at the front and giving it to a domestique and saying, all right, here you go, or just throw it to the side of the road. What are you doing? He goes to the back. He's immediately dodging crashes. Like, of course, as you would at the back, he gets stuck behind because there is a crash. He's a minute off the back pretty quickly. And I think Israel, I kind of wonder if they thought, well, there's only 30 riders left here. We have Dylan Toons. We have Stephen Williams. Would we rather just compete against 30 riders or 100 riders? And maybe they made the calculation of, you know, this looks a little silly, but let's just keep these guys off the back and maybe Dylan Toons could win or get on the podium or Stephen Williams could get on the podium. And he's probably not going to get on the podium ahead of Vanderpool and Tom Pidcock, who were stuck behind.
Yeah, I think at one point you mentioned Carapaz having this look like, man, like I'm going to face the executioner's wrath if I don't stick on Pog's wheel. I think it was Derek G, perhaps, who was at the front pulling UAE behind him. And he had that look about him. it was what we would call an oblock effort for
the
sure.
The money transfer will not go through if I don't. And I'm not saying that's what happened, but that is what it looked like.
Yeah. Speaking of money transfers, it was good to see Astana up there in the mix. Alexei Lutsenko looking good.
Looking really good. And I don't know. Speaking of money transfers, this was a scene of the crime too. I don't know. Me and seven other people watched the Giro di Abruzzo. Lutsenko was unbelievable at that thing. That was the last race he did before Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Lutsenko's back. You think he's gone? And he just comes back. The guy is really good. Like, I would keep an eye out for him. I'm looking at his calendar. Tour of Romandy starts tomorrow. Now I'm intrigued. What can Lutsenko do there?
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm just looking here. So top 11, I believe we have one, two.
The French are back, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We've got four Frenchmen in the top 11. And I'd honestly, Spencer, this doesn't get talked about much, but the anti-doping laws in France are so onerous and the penalties so severe. This does give me a lot of confidence that we're seeing a cleaner pro cycling in this era, because if you're French and you get busted doping, like, you're going to jail.
Yeah, I do think it kind of signals that doping has at least gone. You want to be careful in this. Now, did you see this Chinese swimmer situation where it was like, yeah, how are they all so fast? And it's like, oh, they're all just failing drug tests and WADA's letting them race anyway. Mm. I mean, I don't think cycling is like that. I think if people are doping, it's chipping corners, you know, not using, I think Vodders calls it like oxygen vector doping, which would be EPO or a blood transfusion, but it's more, you know, I have asthma and I could die, so I need to take injections of asthma medication
that are 1,000 times the normal dose.
Yeah. And, you know, that helps, but it doesn't completely disqualify you if you're a clean rider. That's probably what we're seeing here, which is nice.
Yeah. Who knows? It was a great race until it got just super boring.
Wait, so let's talk about Vanderpool really quick. He gets
okay. Third. I have some thoughts here. Yeah.
Pretty good. Pretty dang good finish. So he's gotten sixth and third at this race in his career. Those are his two finishes. You wouldn't think, I mean, it's like 15,000 feet of climbing. People would probably say, oh, that's impossible. I also believe he's the first person since his father in 1986 to finish on the podium at Flanders, Roubaix, and Liège in the same year. I believe also Wout Van Aert, Vanderpool, and Vanderpool's father are the only three riders in modern cycling to finish on the podium at Roubaix and Liège in the same year. So really impressive. Like, you almost can't understate that. I heard some people saying after the race, like, oh, this like confirms he can't win Liège. It's 1,000 meters, too much climbing. I don't think so at all. Like, there's a very real possibility. Imagine Pogacar's not here, which will happen. Like, he will not do this race every year. It's just it's a different race when guys like Remco and Pogacar and Primoz are not at these races. Like, that could have been a sprint for the win. Like, I think Vanderpool could win this race someday. I was really, and he didn't look that good. You know, he was like at the back and he was off. He was out of position when Pogacar attacked. He was on the back on the final climb, which is really steep, like a 12% average. And then the last 5K, he's like, oh crap, I can race for a podium. And he just looked like he came out of nowhere and just pulled his group back. Like, he was 20 seconds off the back at one point, pulled on to the chase group, and then won the sprint for third. Like, that could be the sprint for the win at some point at this race.
To me, Vanderpool maybe had the ride of the race, actually, when you consider just that, I mean, he clawed back, what, almost 2 minutes to get up into position to be able
out. That might be why he looks pretty bad on those climbs.
Yeah, it was a phenomenal ride. And even his crashes, I don't know if you recall this, but in the broadcast, right before he crashed, there was a DSM rider gave him like a, you know, a slight butt push. He was coming back up to the peloton after having gone back to the car. I don't know if that was a buddy of his or what. I don't know. You don't often see riders from other teams just like giving you a push, maybe unless you're the world champion. The next thing you know, we cut to those four guys going, you know, end over end onto the ground, and including a DSM rider. I couldn't tell from the second shot though, because there's no continuity in the way the way these live broadcasts are cut. I couldn't tell if it was the same rider, but there was a DSM rider in that wreck. And what was really remarkable to me, because there was that wreck, and then there was the second wreck, which actually really split the field and then set up that front group that Pogacar jumped from. But Vanderpool avoided both of those wrecks, and he was proximate to both of them. So I thought just the fact that he stayed upright when he was that close to where the action happened in both wrecks was pretty remarkable as well. So just his ability to stay upright and then seemingly just to close those gaps on his own because no one was helping him, and then to just smoke everyone in the sprint was unbelievable. And I also had the feeling that he was exhausted. Like I actually wanted to get your take on this. Given what we've seen him do thus far this year, I mean, it's very difficult to hold like that razor's edge peak for more than a couple of weeks. And I mean, we saw him Flanders, Roubaix. Surely the guy can't still be peaking, right?
Yeah, and he won. You're even forgetting. Remember E3? I think I said
E3. What's that? I don't even remember that. Yeah.
He might have peaked, and he looked pretty dang good at Milano San Remo. I think he could have won that race if he wanted to. That was over a month ago at this point. I mean, there's a reason that not many people podium. I mean, I don't think a double winner has ever podiumed at Liège, unless I'm forgetting someone. And there's a reason that happens. It's almost impossible. If he did look tired to me. And then I would also add, if that's tired, I would love to be Vanderpool tired at some point. Just like, you know, I just kind of like bagged it through Liège, best on Liège. And, you know, I was a minute off the back at one point, but I got back on, and then I had to close some gaps in the final to finish third. It's unbelievable. We should say, I thought it was really interesting when he was on the back, and I'm like, there's a reason I don't do like live commentary, because I'm so reactive. I'm like, he's gone. He's not coming back. It's an 80 second gap. They can't close this. It's impossible. And then of course, Tom Pidcock panics just like I was and says, this isn't happening. I have to attack and bridge. And Pidcock does an amazing attack, an amazing bridge attempt up to the lead group. And Vanderpool's like, hey, summer children, have you never been to a bike race before? Watch this. And he's just sitting in the group, and a team car comes and goes right in front of them, and they just draft the team car all the way back to the peloton. So I was impressed that, I mean, what does he care? The guy's had like a dream season so far, so it's no sweat off his back if he doesn't make it back onto the front. But he just knew, it just felt like he knew a team car was going to come and bail them out at some point. And I was really impressed he didn't pull a Pidcock and panic midway through and try to bridge by himself.
Yeah, another move that impressed me in this race, I have to admit, I'm primarily familiar with Harry Sweeney from his work on YouTube, chronicling, I think he lives in Andorra, and you know, he chronicles his training and kind of life as a pro, also a bit of a, you know, an aspiring professional chef. So he's got quite an interesting YouTube channel. He made the move over to EF from Lotto this season. And wow, I mean, he looked strong. He was up there until the thermonuclear pog attack. But, you know, this deep in the classic season, to see him in front doing the work and eating a lot of wind, I thought was a pretty impressive ride, and portents probably some good things to come for him.
Yeah. The only problem is his team. I mean, what is that? Does that
team? Well, I'm not saying it's going to happen there.
Might have to make a move. I mean, and kind of what's crazy about EF is, and they have some good riders like Ben Healy and Richard Carapaz. Those are good riders. They finished last and second to last in the Vanderpool, you know, one peloton. So the 26th and 27th. And Carapaz, I mean, at this point, you're asking, like, what are they going to get out of him? Like,
Olympic gold medal.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. Mark my words, like, you're going to see him come into some spectacular form circa the Olympics. I really think we're going to see a top five ride from him.
Well, yeah, that is the funny thing about my prompts. He could win the Olympics and Bettyol could win the world championships. It'd be funny if that happened. Not, they get their two biggest wins of the year, not on in EF jerseys, which is very possible. But I think
as you get the gold bike and the gold helmet and can, you know, Van Avermaet for 4 to 9 years, like, you're good.
Yeah. Oh my God. The Vanna Avermaet. That must have been like a 6-year run. That felt like it took forever. And poor Karapaz getting cheated out of a year. I guess you're right. He could win the Olympics. You could never count him out. But even on the women's side, I think it's a little, and someone emailed me about this. I kind of forgotten about it. So they took over the women's team. It was like an independently run women's team that had a long, long history and pedigree. They sponsored it. So they pull their sponsorship from it. It's dead because the two sponsors were EF and Silicon Valley Bank. Silicon Valley Bank doesn't exist anymore. EF says, we're going to start our own team. So they basically fire everyone that's working for that team, bring it all in-house, you know, kind of, I guess, like star-studded signings, you'd say. And then they've just been nowhere in these big races. They had one rider in the winning in the lead group yesterday, Kim Kadzau, who I've never heard of before this, like a young Kiwi, an incredible race for her, but just kind of feels like that whole organization, I just needs a little bit of a shakeup, at least from a performance perspective.
I mean, that's a good point. I don't know why, but this is taking me in the direction of, we're going to have this face off coming soon at Unbound, Spencer. I believe we're going to have Valverde versus Mohoric versus Greg Van Avermaet. And then we have, I'm going to forget this guy's names, the guy who got second last year. What is his name?
Wait, so is it confirmed Valverde's doing Unbound? I saw he's doing Belgian Waffle Ride.
Yeah, Valverde's going to be a Belgian Waffle Ride. He's a Canyon-sponsored rider. I believe that Canyon has their USA headquarters in Carlsbad, I think. So it would make sense. This is like the classic, you bring Remco to BWR Lawrence. Not the year that we did it, the truly great year, but a couple of years.
We like crushed him, man.
Yeah, a couple of years prior to that. But I mean, like, do you see Valverde taking this win over the weekend? First of all, let's start there.
At BWR?
Yes.
Yes, I think Valverde is going to win.
A
lot of these, I mean, I do think that, okay, so Peter Vakok is the guy who got second at, yeah, very good rider. Yeah,
because he got told, I mean, if you got to go back and watch that sprint at Unbound last year, all credit to Keegan for winning. I think he might have had more knowledge of what that finishing shoot was going to look like, but it basically narrowed down to about a 38 centimeter width with like four, like MS-150 riders, like on a charity ride going down the rest of the width of the finishing chute. And yeah, second place got boxed out pretty severely by those other riders.
So yeah, to answer your question, I often think ex-pros are overrated because once you've touched the face of God, so to speak, in the world tour, I think it can be hard just emotionally to be like, oh God, I'm in San, what is it? Not San Marino. It's in like just some town outside of San Diego that I'm sure is wonderful. San Marco, California is where it is. Mm. It's just like, this is not the same. And I think motivation can be a problem. Valverde is not going to have that problem. That guy is flying. He just won a Gravel World Cup. And that course is perfect for him. You know, he's going to crush. I mean, do you think there's any doubt?
Well, it's reading the official press release. It says deepest field ever, et cetera. I'm not seeing a list of starters. I'm sure Michael Marx has it parked somewhere. We're going to have to get that full list of starters. I mean, we know that we're going to get many of the big names from the Lifetime Grand Prix will be out there at the BWR event. I think that barring some kind of equipment catastrophe, Valverde is going to absolutely destroy this field. And I also don't think he's going to have an equipment catastrophe. It seems like he's continued the exact same training load that he's had since. I don't think the man retired. Like he's still
someone
going.
Someone told me that he looked exactly the same. Like, doesn't look like he's gained any weight, which would tell you that he's probably training almost exactly the same. This is earlier. Yeah. Earlier than I in the podcast, and I wanted to get into gravel, but let's run with it. So let's say Valverde comes, dominates. Let's say he dominates both BWR and Unbound. Is this the beginning of the end for gravel as we know it? Like once it just becomes a plan. And also, I know we were hyping up cross-country mountain biking, but what happens if Vanderpool and Pidcock just show up and win the Olympics? Like is it kind of big brothering these other disciplines, and is it hard for them to have their own identity if that keeps happening?
When do we get gravel at the Olympics?
I'm in a group chat where someone keeps saying that this is imminent and other people disagree with them.
Yeah, they might be right. I mean, yeah, there could be other questions like, when are we going to get 24-hour mountain bike racing at the Olympics? When are we going to get Grand Fondo? Yeah.
Grand Fondo Olympics.
I got an email the other day. I'm on some Grand Fondo list. I need to unsubscribe.
pour one out for the Grand Fondos, man.
Yeah.
What happened? Yeah.
They're still going on. There are a lot of like Fondue. People are still dipping. It's still going on. But yeah, there's that question. I would say we've definitely hit that point. I feel like this year is like the year that all the Euros came over and started doing Norba races. And until, geez, I feel like between probably 1995 and 2024, Europeans absolutely dominated cross-country mountain biking. We're seeing the pendulum start to swing back, perhaps because of some innovations happening at an American equipment manufacturer that we might want to talk about. And
well, yes. You
know, a high level of talent, Nika, a few other things. But yeah, I do feel like this is the year that gravel becomes like mountain biking did in 95, where, okay, Mohorič shows up. It's not going to be long before we start seeing probably some real prize money at these races. And I think that these world tour riders and their teams are going to say, sure, like go over there for the weekend. We're going to get some serious mainstream media coverage. And, you know, you're going to pick up a check, get to eat some waffles. Why not?
Yeah, I'm just looking at names here. So Valentin Madouas, incredible rider, really good. Seventh at Liège. You start to think, is it appealing for someone like him? His bike sponsor is a brand I cannot think of. FDJ, who are they sponsored by? But let's say they bring him over, and I don't want to be disrespectful. It's Villiers. Yeah, so that's exactly a brand that needs to, like, a pop in the US. Not to be disrespectful to people racing gravel, but he would be so good. Like, if he really focused on it, people would be shocked at how good he is, and he would be dominating, and he would probably get more coverage for that than he would ever get for getting seventh at Liège, best on Liège, and probably drive more value for his sponsors doing that. You do kind of wonder if that's coming. And, you know, let's just talk about this for a second. We were texting this weekend about, you know, there's this guy, this gravel racer? I've never heard of this guy. What's his name? He's a Mosaic racer.
Oh, Brennan Wurtz, Stanford rower.
Yes. So like massive FTP, 480, I saw, like, according to his 20-minute power test. And you might think 480 watts for an hour, that's Van Aert good. That's Ghana good. Well, it's not quite Ghana good, but that's up there. The other side of the equation here that people are forgetting is the watts per kilo. They're forgetting the kilo. So he's like over 90 kilos. So if we just pull out our little calculator, 480, let's say 90, I mean, that's like 5.3 watts per kilo. That's like me in my fittest. That's not world tour good. You put that in perspective, like Tadej Pogačar is going to go into the tour at probably 7 watts per kilo an hour. So you're almost 2 watts per kilo below, and it matters less, I guess, the less you're climbing. It's not like watts per kilo are everything on a flatter race, but they are still important, and especially as important if you are hitting any climbs on the course. So some of these guys are going to come over with like 6.5 watts per kilo thresholds, and I think that's going to be just difficult for the local, like you'd say, what, the legacy gravel racer to keep up.
Yeah, you know, I've had Dylan Johnson on my podcast a couple of times, and, you know, we exchanged some messages from time to time. His social media following these races, they just had the Fuego XL this weekend over at the Sea Otter Classic. That was the opening Lifetime Grand Prix event of the year. I believe it was a 100K mountain bike race. And Dylan now has this pattern of every post he does following a race is about how he's putting out his best ever, you know, he has his best ever 3-hour power, 4-hour power, FTP in every race. And he progressively is getting lower and lower results. So that's like the story of what's happening in gravel. The US talent pool, which, you know, Dylan's a super talented, deeply committed professional athlete, and it's just not enough to compete against the people who are now coming into the sport, who are world tour level talents. Like, you're never, anybody who's gone out and ridden with a world tour pro before, which I have, I know you have, Spencer, trust me, you're, you know, pros, they're not just like us. You're not like them. They have something you don't have.
No, it's not. And like, Riley Sheehan was on this show last week, filling in for Andrew. And, you know, he's saying he just went up to altitude, just got there, felt terrible coming off Roubaix. He's doing 5-6 hour rides where for an hour on climbs, he's doing around like 270, 280 watts. That's like not, and that's at altitude without having adjusted to the altitude. So that tells you that's even like a low, low, low end of his zone two. You know, if he's like at sea level cruising around at zone two, he's probably over 300 watts, well over 300 watts. You know, that's not normal. Most people cannot ride like that, even very good domestic professionals. I mean, to like think about Messi coming over to the MLS. The guy is older, not what he used to be. And he's coming to the MLS and he's getting just a little bit more space, like maybe a half second more space than he's used to, and he's absolutely dominating. You know, it's kind of the same thing with, I think if Tej Benoot came over and was really focused on gravel, people would be like, wow, this is the best rider we've ever seen, because they don't quite realize how high the level is.
Now, Spencer, I know you've got your assistant coming to pack your bike in a few minutes, so you can get in the car to be taken to the PJ. I did want to quickly address, so the United States loses the 4 UCI Cyclocross World Cup events that it's had for, it seems, probably about a decade. Apologies to everyone out at Valmont. You have a beautiful bike park. Outside of the Valmont, probably like 2 to 6 square mile radius, cyclocross is pretty dead in the United States. Now, as a participant, I always found cyclocross to be one of the most fun and hardest disciplines of cycling that I personally competed in. I loved it. I still watch the pro cyclocross races. I'll admit it, Spencer. I'll even watch those USAC broadcasts where you basically have like a VHS camera on a tripod zooming in and out as the riders go around on the course.
I found memories of
yeah, that. Yeah, they're incredible. Now, what's interesting to me is that the riders who are completely dominating road cycling now all come from a cyclocross, or not all of them, but most of them, including Pogacar, have spent time racing cyclocross. So clearly there's something to be said about what it can do to develop your bike handling skills and just your general ability, probably attention to detail, bike handling, fitness, that benefits you in all other domains of the sport. In the United States, it's totally imploded. It's so dead. And the UCI now came up with a system where they want to have certain World Cup races be mandatory for riders and teams to attend in order to be part of the World Cup, which is important to equipment sponsors. It's important to riders who want a good grid position at the World Championships. And that's because there are several other competitor series that are going up against the World Cup races, and the top level pros were foregoing to things like races in the United States or far-flung locations so that they could, you know, race at more geographically proximate sites. So that's probably why the United States is out. Just teams weren't going to schlep, you know, the 2 different bikes and 8 wheel sets they need for each rider on their quote-unquote team, because there are teams in cyclocross, and fly it all to the United States if there were mandatory events there. Do you think that this is a loss for the sport overall? And what impact, if any, do you think this has on just domestic cycling in the United States from a developmental point of view?
It's a good question. I tend to think it's time. I mean, it just felt like the last few World Cups to hold on in the US, it wasn't what it was. It felt like the UCI could not wait to dump those things. It wasn't the top level of riders. But I mean, in cyclocross, it's in a weird place anyway, because if you're not Vanderpool or Pidcock or Van Aert, you're not a top level rider anyway, even though you could be the best cyclocross specific rider in the world. And I do think Louisville World Championships, what was that, like 2011, 2012, yeah. 2013, one of those years, right. That was big. It just felt like a big moment. But I almost kind of wonder if it expanded too fast in the US as well. Like, did the expansion of those World Cups almost hurt local cyclocross scenes? And then it all felt like it ballooned up and then contracted so fast. And it was like, you know, like a little bit of oxygen left in the room. A few races are taking it, killing the rest, and then they die and then there's nothing left. I almost feel like it needs to build back from the ground up. And you see this even in road cycling. There was this push like globalize, globalize, globalize. Their calendar is going to be all over the world. And like fast forward 10, 15 years, and it's not like that. You know, there was Tour California was once wanting to be a legitimate rival to the Giro d'Italia. And like, where's the Tour of California now? It's dead. Tour of Utah, dead. Tour of Colorado, dead. There's not really any significant major races in the US anymore. There's the two in Canada, but you know, they had the Tour of Beijing, and all these big riders would go do it. You're just seeing a refocus back to Europe, which is, I guess, less sexy for investors, but I tend to think that's where the sport is healthiest, at least for promoters, and you can run profitable events. Like maybe cyclocross just needs to be a Belgian thing with a few races in the Czech Republic and Spain, where all the Belgians are on vacation anyway. And I don't know, maybe the global expansion wasn't the best thing for it, but I do agree with you that, you know, like my son, as he gets more and more riding, like probably do cyclocross before we do anything else. I do think it's the best way to develop a really, really good rider. If there's less cross in the US, that probably means there's less talent being developed in the US as well, which isn't good.
Yeah. And when we speak of the past of domestic racing here in the United States, we would be remiss if we did not mention, of course, the Tour of Missouri, probably the greatest of all of the domestic tours. And
that was the first big race I ever went to.
Yeah,
it was a big race. Yeah, Mark Cavendish was there.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was a great race. And what you just described about the rapid expansion and then the implosion of cyclocross and how that works, do you feel like you're potentially describing the future of gravel?
I do, kind of. Yeah. I feel like gravel, like we're just reliving. I'm a little young for Norba, but I've heard stories, the battles of Norba in the 90s. And then it does feel exactly like cyclocross all over again. Like I remember the cross boom and how big it was. And you know, you go to Valmont and these races would be massive, like massive. And you go now, it's like a ghost town out there. I do think that the same thing's going to happen to gravel, even though, you know, gravel, I do think it's a good, it's going in the right, it's taking people in the right direction. It's getting a bunch of people out to these races. You can race if you want. You can just try to finish if you want. Gravel bikes are probably better bikes for most people. Riding off road or on gravel roads and not on the road is probably better for most people. But from a macro standpoint, I do think it's falling into the same cycle that mountain biking did before it, cyclocross did, and then gravel. Just to go back on one other thing before I try to take this back to Tadej Pogačar. You mentioned an American bike company going away from a certain technology, which could be helping US mountain bikers do well after many, many, many fallow years. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah. So if you take a look at recent Mountain Bike World Cup cross country and short track cross country results, you'll notice that specialized riders are absolutely dominating. Specifically, we've had a handful of American riders up there at the very top of the podium and on the podium a number of times the past couple of weeks. And Specialized dumped its proprietary Brain Shock on its Epic platform, which it had had for more than a decade, I believe. It was like an adaptive suspension system. They're now using the new RockShox. I don't know what it's called, but basically it's an electronic system to control the suspension. So they moved to a different system, and you know, they also have world-class talents like Christopher Blevins, former short track world champion. But it's just incredible to see Americans really in the mix and at times dominating. And Kate Courtney, one-time Specialized rider, I don't know all the details of why she left the team. I have to think that part of it may have been because she wanted to be on better equipment at the time that she made the transfer to Scott. Scott, for a long time, was an innovator and a leader in cross-country suspension technology. Now these Specialized riders are really crushing it, and I have to wonder if some improvements to their gear, coupled with, of course, world-class talent, is part of the margin of victory.
Here's the crazy thing about Kate Courtney. So having had left Specialized after winning the world championships, few bad years, having a pretty good year now probably won't make the Olympics, because Haley Batten and Salvia Blanc, both Specialized riders, right? Or no?
Salvia is not. She's on not. Decathlon Rock Rider. Yeah.
Ford, oddly.
Like, Ford, Decathlon, Ford? Rock Rider. I don't know what the Ford part of that is.
I'm always like, is this the
I don't
same
think Ford, Ford? Yeah, I don't think Ford's making the bike, but I believe it's a Decathlon. It's like
the Decathlon bike.
Yeah. Decathlon Rock Rider. Of course, must be some kind of play on the Specialized Rock Hopper.
Interesting. Lawsuit incoming. But, you know, Haley Batten, you just look at her on the bike, incredible. You just tell, like, incredible athlete, like almost Vanderpoel-esque posture, where just completely controlling the bike, looks like she has a control of the terrain that other people don't. And I do kind of wonder if there hadn't been, you know, and this is like how cycling really grows, if there hadn't been this mountain bike league launch for high schoolers, which has been pretty popular and pretty successful, if she just never even gets into it, you know, and is not even doing mountain bikes. I have no info on how she got into mountain biking. I would just guess that is the path she took.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think Nykaa is playing a significant role in the development that we're seeing both on the mountain bike side of things. And Sepp Kuss, of course, also started his career as a mountain biker. Let's go to go back a bit further. Floyd Landis as well. But, you know, I think we're a bit.
That was Norma, right? I think he was the OG boom.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Floyd was OG. He was a Norma guy for sure.
And so I believe like Cadell Evans was a mountain biker too. Yeah.
Yeah, this is going to feel like I'm trying to throw the football over the mountain, but I remember the first time I saw Cadell Evans in person and saw him race was, and I believe 1999 at Big Bear.
Yeah, and you're not the first person to tell me that this recollection, this made an impact on a lot of people.
Yeah, well, like what I thought was super cool, this is something that they were doing on the Cannondale Volvo team at the time. They had figured out that people were still racing 26-inch mountain bikes at the time. And wow, what an interesting team. Cadell Evans, Tinker Juarez, just like a remarkable group of incredibly talented individuals. And so they're running 26-inch wheel mountain bikes. It was the beginning of the disc brake era. And they realized you could run a 700C wheel with road tires and disc brakes on a mountain bike. So that's what they would do to like warm up and get in, you know, just their like base miles or go out and do training as they would ride. Whoa. Their disc brake mountain bike with 700C wheels.
Crazy. That's 29 birth right there.
There you go.
To take us back where we began, Poetic Symmetry, Tadej Pogačar wins Liège. Probably, I would say without a doubt, the best one day rider of all time, because the only rider you could say challenges him is Vanderpoel. And he is now beating Vanderpoel every time they go head to head. We'll see how the Olympics and Worlds go. But so he's going to go to the Giro. And remember, this is all a warm-up for his Giro Tour double. Let's pencil him in. It's going to be the worst Giro of all time, by the way. Can you imagine how negatively this is going to be raced? Because he's going to take the pink jersey on stage one, and he's probably going to hold it all the way through stage 21, and everyone's going to be racing for second through 10th place. So let's say he wins the Giro. I know I'm skipping over a lot of things that could happen. Let's say he wins the Tour. Andrew, does he have to go to the Volta to do the triple, attempt the treble, which I would say I would have said is impossible before this year?
I'd say, of course, he's going to do it. The guy is a game competitor. He loves a fight, and I think that he's going to want to go for it. What do you think?
I think so, too.
Yeah. That's why I love him. I love this guy. I love Pog. It's boring to watch him win by these margins of victory, but man, this guy always has a smile on his face and wants to punch you in the face. How can you not like him?
I mean, and to defend him, I guess it's boring, but he's also crushing the guy that was so good. We originally said made the sport boring. We were all complaining about Vanderpoel 2 weeks ago. Now it's Vander who? This guy's finishing third. Like, Pog is just so good. I mean, to have six monument victories through your first 13 monument starts, it's almost incomprehensibly good. So let's say he pulls off the treble. I'm skipping through a lot of things that could go wrong. Let's say he wins that. Let's say he wins the world championships.
Olympics. Oh. Olympic gold medal. If Carapaz doesn't take it. Yeah.
Carapaz flats in the last 5K.
Yeah.
Pog wins it. I'm lifting him up on my shoulders in Paris. Is he entering the conversation? Are we talking about potentially the best rider of all time? I mean, the treble would be unbelievable.
The only counterpoint to that might be Vanderpoel being so dominant across so many different disciplines. I still think Pog is the greatest of all time, de facto today.
Yeah, I do have a lot of, I've come around to Vanderpool, and people, the nice thing about the newsletter is people reach out to you with many different diverse opinions and you get to read them. But I've come around to the Vanderpool like being really, really good, probably better than I originally thought. The only thing about Pogacar that I cannot get past in them one-on-one is he is going up against Vanderpool and just dominating him at Vanderpool's main thing. And maybe you could say cyclocross is Vanderpool's main thing, and Pogacar can't beat him at that. But he says, whenever I want to beat Vanderpool in a one day, I just show up and I beat him in the biggest one day races in the world. You could say, well, he didn't show up to Tour of Flanders. I still think he would have won that if he showed up. And then I go and I win Grand Tours. Like, that is unbelievable. I just don't think I've ever seen anything like that. I wasn't alive for the Eddie Merckx era. I'd imagine that was kind of like that.
I think the only thing standing between him and total domination and greatness in 2024 is going to be the Wout versus Pidcock battle that we're about to see at the Tour de France 2024. So just stand by Wout on what we now know is a 54 centimeter frame, which is why you see so much post showing. Thank you, Alman Hallbrook at Velo, for getting that tidbit. It did blow my mind. But I think we're going to see GC Wout hitting on all cylinders and giving Pog a run for his money at the Tour de France. And then I, of course, I'm just deeply interested in what happens when Pidcock shows up ready to go for GC at the Tour. And we see Geraint Thomas getting that diesel engine revved up, coming off the bench with his low to no carb training that, as he and his coach recently shared, enables him to go super deep in those final weeks of the Grand Tour. So we know there's going to be some drama within Ineos as well. It's shaping up to be a hell of a tour.
I like this. Yeah, I like this read on it. Pidcock, I will say, wins Amstel Gold. This is like a quiz you could give somebody. What is Tom Pidcock's most impressive performance of the spring? The fools would pick Amstel Gold. The real ones would say Paris-Roubaix and Liège. His 17th at Roubaix, incredible, when he wasn't even on the start list to begin with. And then 10th at Liège yesterday. You know, after he did not draft the car, he closed down that gap really by himself and then still finished 10th. You know, I do kind of think he's building towards a decent little Tour de France GC campaign. And you know, he's a funny guy. He said he's only doing it so that he can target stages, but I think he's being a bit modest there. I'm curious what he can do. The Wout stuff is, people will say we're unhinged. You're winning me over on this Wout Tour de France GC kick. I actually could see it. And the fact that he trained, the difference between, let's say, like Lance Armstrong, when he crashed in 09, around the same time of year, it was tough for him to build back up for the tour. He did have a good tour. I think he finished third, pretty good. But Wout was peaking before that, you know, so he had a really, really, really good quality training block, got injured, got a rest, an enforced rest, and then now he's building back up again. I don't think his fitness is going to suffer that much from this.
No, I don't either. And I think we're going to see him come back. As we've discussed previously, he's down a few kilos compared to previous years. I think he's going to lean out even more during this injury period. So going back to this watts and kilos to go into watts to kilo ratio, I think he's going to be lighter than ever. I think his watts are going to be the same. And I think that you're going to see a Wout raging like you've never seen him rage before. It's going to be a motors and blow level of ferocity at the tour.
Yes, because we're all sitting around talking about Vanderpool. Wout doesn't like that. It's agitating him. I can guarantee it.
And oh, yeah.
Yeah. When it gets to the July, we're going to say, who's Vanderpool? Well, I don't even remember those spring classics. Where is he right now? It is funny how the pendulum seems to swing on those two. Like one waxes while the other wanes. But I've got to run, Andrew. One quick question for you. So 7 out of the 8 last monuments, solo winners. What is going on with that? Are we going to see people, are they going to start launching attacks in the neutral zone eventually to try to get out in front of the race?
Yeah, of course they are. It's going to make it even more interesting until it becomes more boring, which is what's happened with these super long range attacks.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, it's like in basketball, they realize 3 is worth more than 2. So everyone just shoots 3s now. Maybe people realize, you know, it's easier to win against none than many. So I will just go to the line with no other riders and then I will ensure myself a victory. It could be as simple as that.
How about that? And I think that's a lesson for everyone listening today to carry into your next group ride or meeting at the office. If it's just you out front, you're sure to win.
Yeah, if you have a 7 watt per kilo threshold, you'll just right off the front. It's not that hard. All right, well, thanks, Andrew. And we'll be back next week when I return from my travels.